On the Record with Gavin Riley on News Talk.
Now, there's been a lot of debate this week, as you'll know, around exactly what pubs can and can't do, where they can and they can't serve, and at least for indoors, who they can and can't offer service to. But debates around the conduct of Irish pubs are actually nothing new. On the 7th of July 1905, that's an anniversary that falls this week, the House of Commons in Westminster was debating what was formerly called the Drunkenness Ireland Bill, a deeply contentious act. Donald, stop giggling. Come on, professional. A deeply contentious act which sought to make it an offence to buy a drink for a drunk person in a pub or in another licensed premises. And it also took aim at what it called habitual drunkards. There was even parliamentary debate around banning barmaids and keeping women out of pubs altogether, all of which caused great debate, with Irish MPs considering the legislation as a slight upon the country. But it is nonetheless an important moment in the history of the Irish pub. And Donal Fallon, who, as you can hear, is there snickering away in the corner of the studio, is coming to talk about it.
They might need the Drunkenness England Bill after the result last night. The scenes look great.
It is indeed coming home, and by it I mean the hangover. There were many people out to close pubs in Ireland at the time of the Drunkenness Ireland Bill, but those people weren't just in Ireland.
No, they weren't. And I mean, a tavern, the great Dr. Jonathan Swift insists, it is a place where madness is sold by the bottle. And as is often the case, Swift wasn't entirely wrong. And in the opening years of the 20th century, the role of the tavern or the pub and booze more broadly is, you know, raising sometimes surprising political questions right across these two islands. In England, there were Salvationists from the ranks of the Salvation Army, sometimes Socialists who felt that drink was a hindrance to kind of the emancipation of the workers. And in Ireland, there was an enormous significant, you know, temperance movement and quite a lot of nationalists who were very much opposed to the pub. Ireland sober, Ireland free. But this week coming marks the anniversary of what I think has to be one of the strangest bills ever brought before the House of Commons, and one which popped up several times in 1905, specifically aimed at combating drunkenness, not throughout the United Kingdom, but as the name puts it, the Drunkenness Ireland Bill here. And, you know, it's an interesting moment in Anglo-Irish parliamentary history, because while it failed, a lot of its core was eventually implemented, the Sunday closing of bars and the like. Oh. And, you know, it's particularly interesting to study also in terms of language and the way in which Ireland was spoken about. I don't think this did a great deal to bring the sides together.
Yeah, it might have been a more Punch magazine approach to doing things. Pubs, of course, as you mentioned there, they're not uniquely Irish, but we did have more of them per head than our neighbours did.
Yeah, and you know, Salford, Birmingham, London, they all had pubs and plenty of pubs. But perhaps what was uniquely Irish was their you know, predominance. Just the number of them was staggering. And the great George Russell said, "It is merely absurd that a country struggling desperately to find its feet should attempt to maintain, in proportion to its population, twice as many licensed houses as England and three times as many as Scotland."
Yeah, I wouldn't have thought we were three times as many as Scotland, in fairness. That's kind of sobering.
Russell went on to list towns. We won't name them on the radio because there's probably listeners in all of them, which had no libraries but boasted of six pubs to a tiny population. So there was a predominance of pubs in Ireland that was unmatched throughout the rest of Britain. And I think that is at the core of how this insanely titled bill, the Drunkenness Ireland Bill, ends up before Westminster.
Of course, the solution there would just be to make the pubs libraries and to make the libraries pubs. Easy solution for everyone. The temperance movement's heyday was but a memory by the time that this bill was going through the House of Commons.
Yeah, 19th century Ireland had witnessed that incredible drive of the temperance movement. Father Theobald Matthew, that statue on O'Connell Street in Dublin of Father Matthew. Actually, the unveiling of that statue was interrupted by a drunk, which I've always thought was very... and that's a fact. That's in the newspaper reports. So perhaps some journalists made that up because it was a brilliant yarn. But the newspapers claimed that the unveiling of the statue was interrupted by a drunk. But there was the total abstinence society, and the numbers are amazing. I mean, this is 1840s Ireland. This is a time before social media or modern transportation. 100,000 people take the pledge at Galway in 2 days. 20,000 people in Nina on a single day. And when Frederick Douglass, you know, the great abolitionist, comes to Ireland, he meets Daniel O'Connell, and we all know about that because, you know, Barack Obama told us about it. But he also meets Father Theobald Matthew. He takes the pledge and he says his whole soul appears to be wrapped up in the temperance cause. You know, Ireland seems to be enthralled with temperance in the 19th century. But by the early 20th, to be honest, the temperance movement is kind of on the wane. So parliamentarians find themselves debating a bill with a deeply offensive title, and one Irish MP stands up and says this act is uncalled for, ill-considered, mischievous in its provisions, and needlessly offensive to every Irish man who had any regard for the fair fame of his country.
So talk to us then about exactly what this very contentious bill wanted to do. Was it trying to like close pubs altogether, or was it just trying to come down with a firm fist on what you could do inside them?
So bills like this had come before the House of Commons before, and essentially what it wants to do is reduce the availability of alcohol. So not stop people drinking entirely, okay, but reduce the ability.
This isn't
of
like American 1920s prohibition.
No, exactly. It's what they're looking for, some kind of happy medium. So earlier acts, for example, had tried for a complete closure of public houses on Sundays, more limited hours on other days. And Sunday, for whatever reason, was specifically, you know, identified as being a day of drunken disorder. Archbishop Paul Cullen said, almost all the crime we have to deplore in Ireland may be traced to drunkenness. And as long as the doors of the public house stand open during the leisure of the Sunday, it will be very difficult indeed to root out from among our people that degrading vice. Ooh. So whatever it was about weekend drinking, it was supposed to one day most people had off in Victorian society. But it was targeted throughout the 19th century and into the 20th. And not everything in the 1905 Drunkenness Ireland Bill was a bad idea, to be honest. It sought to financially protect the spouses and families of habitual drunkards, people who were being turfed out on the streets because, you know, okay, the husband was drinking the wages, and spoke of penalties for those found drunk while caring for children.
Now, all of this begs what might be an obvious question, but actually might not be obvious when you think about it, because this is the days before breathalyzers, this is the days before blood alcohol content. So even defining drunkenness could be a bit of a challenge.
Yeah, one Irish MP stands up and he takes exception to Clause 11, which is ludicrous. Imposes a penalty for aiding or abetting a drunk person in obtaining liquor in or in the immediate vicinity of any licensed premises. Now, that's illegal to buy a pint for a drunk person, you know, which is unenforceable in any public house. But it was, he said, most difficult to define drunkenness. Some thought a man was drunk if he showed signs of exhilaration after a glass of beer. Others would wait till he'd fallen down. And Westminster erupts into laughter. But there's a good point in there. It's another MP stands up and says there are healthy influences at work in Ireland challenging the habit of the people in respect to drink, but also made the point, are drunken people in Ireland any worse than those in England, Scotland or Wales? And I think the Home Rulers didn't really take kindly to the idea of Ireland being a kind of guinea pig, not for the first or last time, for any kind of legislative social change. And this is a time when Westminster is a very tense place. The Conservatives are, you know, on the cusp of losing power, and they've been in it since 1895. Change was just around the corner. And I don't think a lot of Irish Home Rulers appreciated the way the good, plain people of Ireland were being spoken about.
Just on the topic, by the way, of how it's unenforceable to try and ban the sale of drink to drunkards, it also still is part of Irish contract law to this day that you can't enter into a contract to buy anything if you're not of sound mind. So arguably, if you're drunk, you don't have the capacity to pay for another drink, legally speaking anyway, which is always a curious one. The bill anyway falls in 1905. But another bill comes back, another MP comes back with a more radical proposal a little bit later on. And this one is very radical because he wants to ban barmaids.
Yeah, so the Drunkenness Ireland Bill failed, probably primarily because of its name and the fact it was specifically just targeted at one quarter of the empire, or of the islands, I should say. But most of what's contained in it later passes. And they go on this amazing journey in the aftermath of the failure of this bill, where other MPs, teetotalers, you know, start throwing other things into the mix that they want to see. So a bill is introduced in October 1906, which calls for the abolition of barmaids. And to quote one historian, an MP argued that this measure would protect young women from the attentions of inebriated customers and ensure that men would not be lured into drinking by attractive servers.
Extraordinary. Oh, if there's one thing that's going to cause alcoholism, so, it's very pretty barmaids, clearly.
So this leads to what I think is one of the most incredible moments of trade union agitation in British history, the birth of what's called the Barmaids Political Defence League, spearheaded by Irish suffragist Eva Gorboot, sister of
Markovitch.
Constance Gorboot, who we better know as Markovitch. So kind of pub politics are now at their height. You know, you have Irish people being offended that the country's being labelled a nation of drunkards, feminists in England being offended that the jobs of barmaids are to be lost. And you end up with this amazing moment where these radical Irish sisters, the Gorboots, are canvassing barmaids in Britain, mobilising them. Markovitch actually tells people to vote for the Conservative candidate in Manchester in the election because he's a supporter of the barmaids. I've come over from Ireland to help because I'm a woman. I'm not a Conservative, I'm a Home Ruler, but I've come over here to ask everyone to vote for Mr. Johnson Hicks because he, of the three candidates, is the only one who takes a straight and decent view of the barmaids' question. So we know Constance Markovitch for all kinds of reasons in this country. You know, founder of Fianna Fáil, socialist before that, first woman elected to the Westminster Parliament. Very few of us know her as the defender of the humble British barmaid. Yeah. It's more forgotten.
What's worth remembering there is that that's also a time where not even any woman, not even the landed gentry women, have a vote. So then you're basically canvassing for lads to save the barmaids because they want something to look at for their halfway on a Saturday or when they're still open on a Sunday. Of course, we forget, and you know, post Markovitch and everything else, 1916 and beyond, we get our independence, but for convenience sake and for continuity's sake, we decide to keep all of the laws that we inherited from Westminster anyway. And some of Westminster's laws laws on pubs are still around for decades afterwards.
Absolutely. You know, some of what Westminster passes in relation to our public houses outlasts the Breakwood Empire. So it was an Irish MP, James O'Mara, who got St. Patrick's Day as a national holiday. And you hear his name every year, it pops up in the, you know, things you didn't know about Patrick's Day newspaper articles. What they don't tend to mention is that he also ensured that the pubs had to close in the day. And they remained closed.
It's a double-edged sword.
For decades. I'm open to correction. I think it was right into the 1970s. Mm. So some of the legislation that was passed in Westminster regarding when we can and can't drink and where we can and can't drink was on the books for a long, long time.
And of course, we shouldn't either pretend that this was only a Westminster thing, that even after independence, we do introduce some of our own pub legislation, some of which goes far above and beyond what that bill in 1905 was trying to do.
The Holy Hour is an extraordinary thing. Like, young listeners won't believe the Holy Hour exists.
I had to be reminded of the Holy Hour by my parents a couple of weeks ago, and I just like was aghast at the idea that you were allowed to open after Mass and then shut again and then reopen again.
Yeah, it's
just
it's
how utterly impractical it was.
Extraordinary. Kevin O'Higgins, Minister for Justice in the First State, it limped into the 1980s, but it kind of forced the closure of public houses in some cities, like a handful of cities, between 2:30 and 3:30. On paper, I think it was to curb afternoon drinking by workers more than anything.
But on a Sunday.
Yeah, but it's extraordinary, isn't it? And who knows how the Home Rulers would have felt about such a thing had it been put to them decades earlier.
If there's one thing that we should take away from this lot, it is that Constance Markievicz isn't just, you know, the leader of the Women's Brigade in 1916, or the person who held the battle over St. Stephen's Green, or the person who said to hide a gun in your petticoat. She is also the defender of the barmaid. And let that be the takeaway message from all of this. Donal Fallon, as ever, thank you very much. Donal Fallon, author of the Come Here To Me book, and as well of Henrietta Street from Tenement to Suburbia, available in all good bookshops now. Someone who I suspect might be using some of Sunday to avail of the services of barmaids or barmaid. A fond patron of all of those establishments he is. Donal, thank you as ever. Also the presenter, by the way, of the Three Castles Burning podcast, which you'll find anywhere you get your audio online.
On the Record with Gavin Riley
on News Talk